Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that introduces to WFIU listeners interesting people from Indiana, the United States, and the world. I'm Owen Johnson. Our guest on this occasion is Jamie Terabay, a correspondent for National Public Radio and author of A Crazy Occupation, Eyewitness to the Intifada. Jamie, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you for having me.
Your family is Lebanese, but you spent most of your growing up years in Australia.
Yes.
How did you get there?
We were all born there. My father basically left Lebanon when he was very young, traveled around the Middle East, spent a lot of time in the Gulf, and I believe there was one point where it was France and Australia were both sort of admitting immigrants, and he decided to go to Australia. And, you know, long story short, my mother, he met her on a trip back to Lebanon. They married. And since then, they've just been in Australia and making a life there.
How often did you visit Lebanon as a kid?
Let me see. We actually did try to move and live there a couple of times. And each time we had to leave because of, you know, violence that erupted every, you know, it was these thwarted attempts by my father to resettle in Lebanon. It didn't really ever work. But, you know, I would say every 3 to 4 years or so we had a visit up until the point where I was 15. That was the last time we sort of lived there for any period of time and came back to Australia and really focused on finishing school and going to university and carrying on. So, yeah.
So at age 15, and I guess a couple of years before that, you would have been old enough to been able to reflect in some way on the experience there. What was it like those years?
You don't really know everything that's going on because you're seeing it through your very small world, and you're in a very sheltered part of, you know, we were living in this tiny little village in the mountains just outside of Beirut, and when all the bombs were going off, because we spent 10 months in the bomb shelter at one point, and you're only hearing one side of the story, but you are also seeing what it's like to be in the middle of a conflict and the propaganda that comes out, because, you know, different radio stations belong to different political parties and different television stations, and you know, they all had their own commercials, and you didn't know who was right, but they all insisted that they were, and you're hearing, you know, certain points of view depending on where you're living, so you're never really getting a clear picture. But it's really interesting because just the way it sort of manifested itself in me and my sisters years later was very, you know, very striking. I for some bizarre reason, I obviously did not have enough, decided to get more combat experience. But, you know, the rest of my sister, my older sister was very sort of very strongly focused on being with the family and staying with the family. And my other two sisters were, you know, less affected by it, but still, you know, there was a period of time when I heard loud noises and I jumped, and that was because of that. And now I do it for altogether different reasons.
How did you get interested in journalism?
I like to write. I love to write. You know, when I was I've been writing stories for as long as I can remember, and it was one of the things that I used to do when we were stuck in these bomb shelters in Lebanon. I used to write stories to entertain my sisters, and yeah, I didn't know what I wanted to do at university, so I just studied what I liked. And then when I got out, I was in this horribly boring corporate job, and I was bored out of my skull. And I just literally one moment just thought, wouldn't it be great if I could do what I liked and get paid for it? And what would that be? Well, I like to write. Well, I quit my job, took an enormous pay cut, and went to work as an editorial assistant for a magazine. And then after that, I took another pay cut and went and worked as an editorial assistant at Australian Associated Press. And then I got an internship, and that's pretty much how it went.
Hmm.
Yeah, really starting at the bottom.
Was your first international posting Jerusalem?
It was Singapore.
Singapore.
Actually, yeah.
What kind of experiences did you have there?
You know, Singapore is an anomaly in Southeast Asia. It's one of the safest places. It's also probably one of the most predictable. So it was the financial center because it was so secure and stable. So a lot of the work that I was doing there was centered on financial news, But there was at the same time all that turbulence going on in Indonesia. Suharto was dealing with East Timor and the referendum, and then the Australian intervention in East Timor, and there was all this stuff going on the periphery. So I got to see some of that as well. But, you know, by and large, it was a lot of conferences and, you know, lots of APEX and OPEX and things like that, and not really thrilling stuff, really.
I've probably jumped over one question, and that is, how did you decide you wanted to go from a career in journalism to one that involved foreign reporting?
That was a boyfriend. the guy I was dating at the time got a promotion in Singapore, and I basically went with him and cast about with different people. I interviewed with Reuters and Dow Jones and CNBC and all those people, and AP were the ones who hired me in the end. So that's really where that started. But it was really just okay, you know. And I've always been predisposed to travel. I mean, by the time I was 15, I hadn't spent more than 4 years in the same country, so I was all about going different, you know, going to different places and experiencing different things. So for me, it was no big deal. So let's go and try it, and I did. You know, the career lasted; the relationship did not.
did you choose then to go to Jerusalem, or did the AP choose you?
The offer came out of the blue, and I thought it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I really wasn't sure what to expect, but it was around the time of everyone, you know, talking about Palestinian state. You know, it was the Clinton era. It was Barack and Arafat, and they all seemed to be getting along. And, at the time I was interviewing for the job, they were meeting in Camp David. So by and large, I was meant to start in September, and September 13 was the day that the Palestinians were expected to declare statehood in 2000, we're talking. And so, you know, it was like, okay, there's a new era in the Middle East, and it would be exciting, of course, and I've never been there and never been to Jerusalem. It would be great to go. I mean, it's an amazing opportunity to go. So, of course, there wasn't even a question for me anyway.
It might be helpful if you could take a little bit of time to explain to our listeners then what did happen when you got there.
Well, I arrived on September 18, 2000. And then September 28, 2000, Ariel Sharon went for a walk in the old city on the Temple Mount, or as you know, the Palestinians call it the Haram al-Sharif, with about, you know, several hundred Israeli police. And that was considered a great insult. And the next day, Palestinians rioted, and the Second Intifada was born.
And from there, then, you had some challenges in your reporting. What did you try to do when you're reporting this story generally over those several years?
You know, in the beginning, it was – everything was a big deal. Every Palestinian who died from, Israeli bullet in those early demonstrations was a big deal. Every funeral was a big deal. And then it got to the point where the numbers just became a line in the story, and it all just seemed to make no sense at all. And you just thought, when is it going to end? When is it going to be enough? And you, I could never make sense of it, because it just – living in Jerusalem and seeing how similar the two people are, it just struck me as it was so obvious that, of course, they're destined to live together. They have practically the same language, the same culture, the same food. You know, they're religious people behaving the same way that, you know, their women cover up. You know, they have very large families. You know, they just, like, point out the differences to me, please, you know. So for me, I was incredibly naive, because there's obviously all these political undercurrents that you're not aware of. I was 25 years old. And I was running around between people getting stoned and tear gassed and shot at. And I just thought, really, you know, why can't we all just get along? And I couldn't see. And for me, I guess because I've traveled so much and I've never really felt – I mean, I feel Australian, and there's also part of me that's quite Lebanese. But I've never sort of felt attached to a piece of land. So I never really could understand I'm not even say the passion, but just the intensity that people feel, that they felt about this conflict and, you know, meeting children who were like, well, I'm going back to my house in what is now Israel, and just saying to them, well, what if there's a supermarket there now? What if there's a Jewish family living in there? It's like, well, no, they have to leave. It's like, but and there's no sort of, you know, give and take. And just, it was very puzzling for me, and it was very difficult to sort of, you know, comprehend.
How much difference did it make to you as a reporter with your ethnic and religious background?
Well, I think because I'm Christian, I wasn't pulled into either side, so I could be quite objective about it. Culturally, it made it very easy for me to speak to Palestinians. Obviously, I speak Arabic, so that was a huge bonus. And you know, they're very, you know, Arabs are very willing to embrace you. You know, one of the first nights of the Intifada, I was actually sleeping on the floor of one of our Palestinian staffers' living room because I, you know, basically got stranded. I didn't have any clothes. You know, I was just staying overnight, and his wife lent me her yellow pajamas, and, you know, and we had dinner, and then we had breakfast, and, you know, and this is what they do. You know, it's like you come in, and it's something that's very Lebanese as well. I mean, I've spent nights at one of my uncle's house. There was 15 people all sleeping on the floor because, you know, no one wanted to leave. They all wanted to stay over, and, you know, I mean, so from that point of view, that was very familiar to me, and it was easy to adapt to that. But there were obviously other sort of cultural mores that I really didn't that didn't fly with me too well. But it did help a lot. It gave me a bit of context to understand where people were coming from.
What about the difference in being a woman in reporting?
I was lucky because I had the Arabic, I think. You know, it's a double-edged sword. If you have the Arabic and people find out that you're a Lebanese, and they feel like, well, wait a minute, how can you be doing this? What does your husband say? What does your father say? You know, blah, 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 blah. And then on the other hand, it's like, I'm going to go and I'm going to talk to anyone I want. And I've been able to have extraordinary access because of that. And, you know, male reporters can't walk into a house full of women and not offend everyone, you know, and I did that constantly. I did that in Iraq constantly. I'd be, you know, embedded with soldiers, and we're doing a walk through a neighborhood, and, you know, there's a house with all these women in it. They can't go into the yard, and I'm coming inside, and they're like, come on, sit down, have some coffee, you know, and we'll sit and we'll chat. I mean, that's always been something for me that I've been able to do and not even think twice about. It's like, well, and, you know, as for the rest, I can get all the other interviews as well. It doesn't make a difference. But there's also that other world that a lot of men don't have access to because of the cultural restrictions. So,
the Associated Press in the past had a tradition of doing breaking stories, what's happening today. Did you have the liberty in Jerusalem to do more in-depth stories to try to really explain what was behind the story?
You know, there were a lot of it is, you're right, a lot of it is breaking news, and a lot of us in the Bureau, that was our role. Our role was to be out there in the field ringing up and saying, okay, I'm in Jenin, I've just found 5 bodies, you know, and that goes into a story that someone is writing in Jerusalem and it goes out that way. But, you know, every now and then I did get to do a couple of pieces that I was, you know, quite proud of. The stories of Palestinian collaborators, which was always very interesting. You know, people who Israel, you know, would pay or would give them jobs or facilitate their movement through the West Bank into Israel, so to help their families in return for information, and the way that they were treated when they were, you know, busted basically by the Palestinian authorities, and what that really says about the society and just the way that they react to it. You know, I did a couple of pieces on that, and you know, there were other things, you know, that I did get to spend time and say, you know, this deserves some thought and some, you know, some context. And it's nice to be able to do that. And you don't really have the luxury of doing it in a breaking news environment. when you don't even have a computer or electricity or anything. But to have the time to do it is great. Yeah, I did a lot of that in Janine as well, just because it was, oh, wait a second, you know, let's take a step back and let's take a look at this from a different perspective. I was so – there was a moment in Janine because, you know, I don't know if you remember, but in 2002 – Operation Defensive Shield, the Israeli army went into the West Bank and basically declared many areas closed military zones. And there were all these rumors coming out of the Jenin refugee camp that there'd been the massacre. You know, Saeb Erekat went on CNN and I think he said there were like 500 dead. So my job essentially was, Jamie, go and find the bodies. So I did. You know, every day at 5 o'clock in the morning, we would hit the road and we would try to find a road into the camp without, you know, and it was basically cat and mouse. As soon as we were found by the Israeli soldiers, we were booted out. So the point, it was almost a contest of how much could we do before they found us and kicked us out. And, you know, every day I would go in there and every day, I think this was like over a 10, 12-day period before the restrictions started to ease off and more people were coming in. You know, every day you would meet a little kid and he'd go, I'll take you to where the bodies are. And like, okay. So, you know, you found like five men burnt, you know, in an apartment building or, you know, an old woman stuck in, you know, a rooftop, you know, on her own. And it just – but it also I would go to the hospital and we would literally count the bodies with – I would count them with the people in the registry office. And, you know, you'd go to the back of the hospital building with them and there's like a sand lot and there's shallow sort of graves and you would count with them. And you know, because I was so adamant that I had to find out exactly for myself, if not for my job. But because, you know, you need to know these things. And if there really were 500 dead, then people really should know about it. And the worst thing is that in the end, it was probably about 50-odd, but because it wasn't 500, it was almost like it didn't matter. And that was the saddest thing.
Did you ever fear for your personal safety there as a journalist?
In terms of people wanting to kidnap me?
Yes, to kidnap you or to kill you.
No. That never happened. We were very I was, you know, it was a different time. It really was because people never saw us as, you know, involved in either way. We were not combatants. We were journalists. And Palestinians really understood the use of the media. They worked the media very well. You know, the bringing kids out, you know, in demonstrations and you know, allowing the press the access that they did. You know, the journalists who were shot when they were sort of caught up with in Palestinian groups, more often than not by Israeli soldiers, you know. And I just, the only times I actually ever feared for my safety was, you know, I was in Gaza. And after a suicide bombing, the sort of expected retaliation from the Israeli government was to send a couple of F-16s and bomb something. And, you know, you're driving around Gaza and you see these things in the sky and you think, okay, I don't know where you're going to hit and I have no idea where I should be. And that's when you sort of think, okay. But, you know, I've been shot at. I've been but, you know, I've been tear gassed and I've had 100 things happen to me. But I never ever felt that as a journalist someone was going to kill me and someone wants me. That never happened until Iraq for me. And that was obviously a direct consequence of Daniel Pearl. Before that, at least in the Middle East, from my understanding and from what I know, journalists weren't really considered currency. You know, I think they are in places like South America, but in the Middle East, it was more like, okay, we can use them. But in Iraq, it was a different thing. You know, Zarqawi didn't need the media to get his message out, so we were irrelevant and actually could be useful for other purposes.
In your book about this experience with the Intifada, a book called A Crazy Occupation, what were you trying to accomplish with that book?
Therapy. I left Jerusalem in January, February 2003, just as the Iraq war was heating up. And I went back to Australia and I really did it to sort of collect myself because 3 years of living as I did can make you really hard. It can make you very cold. And I really wasn't liking the person that I was becoming. You become very cynical and very bitter. And And I just didn't want to live like that. And I needed to sort of be with my family again. I needed to be with people where everything wasn't a question of life and death. And I realized once I got home, and people would ask, but, you know, they're not really that interested. But it was all in my head. And the way for me to sort of deal with it was to write it all down. And I just wrote and wrote and wrote. And one of my friends said, hang on a second. I mean, I'll give you your stuff to a guy I know. And he said, okay, keep writing. Okay. And that's really where that came from. But ultimately, I mean, I just want to be able to do it to say, okay, this is something that my kids can read and say, Mummy did this once upon a time. Because I really actually thought at that point that was the end for me. I wasn't going to do anything else after that. But then that was 2003.
To what degree is the book a personal story, and to what degree is it a story about the events?
I think it's probably 70-30. This is definitely my sort of I like to say it's unofficial title should be The Year of Living Stupidly, because I was just young and naive and did the craziest things that you could never do today.
The question sometimes comes up with people who have done war reporting that they want to get away from it, but when they're away from it, they miss it. Did you have any of those feelings when you were back in Australia?
I was jumping out of my skin with the Iraq War. I mean, it was a big hoo-ha for all of us, really. I knew a lot of people who a lot of my friends were dragged out of Baghdad kicking and screaming in the lead up to the invasion because of the fear that all the news networks had. I mean, if you remember, I think there were like 10, 12 people left in Iraq at the time, you know, because the networks and the news organizations just didn't want to risk that many people. And those who I knew who were there were, you know, doing things like buying microwave ovens because they thought that would protect their satellite phones in case of a chemical attack. I mean, for goodness sake, you know. And I remember even being in Jerusalem right before the war started and being given a chemical suit. You know, you've got to put this on in 10 seconds or you die. And you think, oh, my God. But everyone I knew in that world was just absolutely obsessed with Baghdad because it was the biggest story ever. And unlike the Palestinian conflict where, you know, it was a revolving door. You could go in and out any time you wanted. Going in and out of Baghdad was always a big deal. And the opportunity to go in there and be able to report unfettered was just irresistible to everyone. Everyone was there. It was crazy. You know, it was really like a big reunion for so many people. You'd go there and you're like, oh, you're here. I haven't seen you since in 2001. But it was just very difficult to watch something like that unravel and not be part of its history. And really, you want to be – I think the best thing about this job is being able to witness history. And I think that's why so many people like to do it. Well, that's why I like to do it.
How did you wind up going to NPR?
It was 2005. I was in Cairo and I wasn't really doing a lot. I was doing a lot of editing. I wasn't doing a lot of reporting for the AP at that point. I was quite frustrated. And Lulu Navarro, who's in Baghdad at the moment, was also working at AP until 2004. And she jumped across to NPR and she said, there's a vacancy. It's in Baghdad. You should take it. You should apply. And I said, oh, I don't know. I've never done radio before. I don't know how I'd fit. I don't know how I'd like it. And she said, no, you'd love it. I love it. You should do it. And I applied and, you know, next thing you know, I was in Baghdad again for NPR and reporting, doing it for radio, which was something that I'd never done before. And it was a huge challenge. I think that was one of the reasons I did it, because it was a challenge, because it was new, because it was different. And also because, you know, Baghdad was completely unresolved. You know, it was getting very dangerous, but there were still so many things that that I still had questions about.
When you went to radio, was it hard to think about how you're going to report a story as compared to what you did for the AP?
Absolutely. I mean, you know this. Doing a story for radio, if you don't have it on tape, it never happened. You know, it's like being a photographer and not having the picture. You can write anything. You can write what someone says, even if you don't have his words on tape. You can describe something. You can spend. You know, you can't put that much text in a radio story. And one of the best pieces of advice that anyone ever gave me about radio reporting was to think of sound as my adjectives. And you know, just listening to the work that everyone does, and that's the best way to learn for me. I would pull up stories on the internet from the bureau and just, you know, hear the different ways that people were, you know, reporting a story, and I was constantly saying, "Oh, I didn't know we could do that. That's so cool." And, you know, just trying to apply different things, you know, and it was fun to learn. And, you know, just sticking your microphone in everyone's face, it's unnerving, but people also like it a lot. And, you know, I think they take it a bit more seriously than when you just have a notebook in your hand and you think it's just flimsy, what have you got there? This is nothing. And then you pull out a big, you know, shotgun mic and they're like, okay, I'll talk to you. Yeah, so.
Couldn't it work the other way as well when you have just the notebook? It's just you and the source.
Yeah. But when you have people who are sort of media aware, and you know you're sort of jostling for space and attention with television networks, for example, the contest for the biggest mic wins.
We turn now to some music that you've picked. This is Better Things by the Kinks. Why did you choose that one?
I sing that to my little boy, Jake, when he's fussy, which is all the time lately. But I love that song. And it's just one of my favorites. It's a very positive song.
That was Better Things by the Kinks, music chosen by our guest on Profiles today, NPR correspondent Jamie Terabay. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com.
Did you have any special war training or anything for safety and security before you went to Iraq?
When we were in Jerusalem, we got sent to England for the hostile environment training course. And it was funny because they do teach you kidnapping scenarios, but it's in a situation where they actually want to keep you alive. And, you know, you're taught survival skills. You're taught to be, you know, Mr. Gray, the person who's sort of not there but is there and not, you know, not obvious but not completely invisible that people question, you know, and start to actually focus on you more. All sorts of things like – and one of the things that I still, you know, adhere to because I don't enjoy crowds as much as I used to is securing your exit. So when you go into a situation, you always got to know how you're going to get out of it. You know, look for the door. If a riot erupts here, which is the easiest way for me to get out? And that's something that I still do. First aid, how to avoid snipers and which way to duck when the grenade goes off and, you know, all sorts of things like that. And a lot of it was useful. It certainly teaches you that it's very serious. Because you think it's a lark and, you know, a lot of people in this career sort of, you know, like to brag about how many times they get shot at or how many times they get shot and blah, blah, blah. But I remember the day that we arrived in Hertfordshire in England to do this story, to do this training, one of the girls, a freelance photographer, was shot in the stomach in Bethlehem. And so, it was just – it seemed even more necessary to do this training at the time.
Was this something that you chose to do, or did AP say you must do it?
AP said we must do it.
How do you deal with danger? I think you've had some experiences with improvised explosive devices, with kidnapping.
Well, the IED that went off, I still have trouble listening to the tape of that because it still is very jarring for me. It's something that happens every day to a lot of to the soldiers I was with. It happened several times a day, so they were able to deal with it much better than me. But I was so obsessed with making sure I made my deadline for morning edition that I just chose to just compartmentalize that. And when I finally got back to the base and I phoned my husband, who was my boyfriend at the time, and I said, this is what's happened. And I'm really worried that, my editor is going to be so annoyed with me because I missed my deadline. And he said, Jamie, just stop for a second and realize what just happened. And you, at the time, you really can't because you've got to keep going. You've got to work. You've got to focus. I went back and I filed my story and I filed the story, the reporter's notebook that I did on the IED. And then I had to go out on an overnight mission with the soldiers. And, I was going. And it was literally when I got back to the bureau in Baghdad that I was able to stop and think, oh, my God, this just happened to me. And, that's when, you're getting hundreds of emails from people saying, are you okay? Are you okay? And you're like, yeah, fine. Whatever. It happens to everyone. This is one thing that I didn't have. I can cross that off the list now. There's a lot of bravado there. But there, you do stop and you think, there but for the grace of God, and if he'd gone, because there were three IEDs on that road, and we hit one of them, and if he, if the soldiers had ignored the warnings for the other two, there was one that was a landmine that he, the team leader, was absolutely convinced would have killed us all, and just everybody. So many of my colleagues have had situations where they've been in Humvees that have got blown up, and then they've come under fire, and it's scary stuff, and you've got to be very frank about the dangers, and just this is reality. This isn't some fantasy world where you're just war correspondent and you're all big and tough and infallible. And this is real. This is you could die. And there are so many people who are affected by what happens to you, whether you feel responsible or not. There's this world out there, people who care about you, who don't stop watching CNN because you're in a dangerous place that you got to think about. And when that happens, you really got to stop and take stock of everything. So it's not easy.
And yet you go on.
Yeah, well, I've stopped for the moment. But, I come back to this thing of witnessing history, and I just really believe that, especially with the way things are looking now with journalism, that if, these foreign bureaus are all shutting down, and if we don't do it, then how are people going to know? How do people find out about things that are happening in you wouldn't know about stuff in Rwanda, you wouldn't know about Cambodia, you wouldn't know about Iraq, you wouldn't know about any of these things if there weren't journalists out there doing it, And some of us have decided that this is what we do. And I will, I do want to go back and do it all over again, and I will at some point. But it's a responsibility as well as a privilege, and I really believe that. I believe that, we have this unique opportunity to see the world as it is and to be able to tell people about it. And it's a huge responsibility. I really, really profoundly believe that.
The next question I want to preface by saying I would ask this of you, whether you are a man or a woman, does having a child make a difference in your approach to this?
Yeah. Well, it does because, it has to be a really good reason now for me to leave him, you know. And, I got married last year and now I have a baby, and those are huge life events. And, you know, I mean, timing is everything. You know, I like to tell people that there's a time and a place for everything, and there are different chapters in your life. And this chapter right now is my family, and my family is also incredibly supportive of me doing foreign reporting. And my husband is keen for me to, take that back up again. But, you know, I'd like to wait for Jake to be at least 5 years old before, you know, mommy goes off to another war zone so he can at least understand why she's doing it. But, it's just life, you know. Priorities shift. You know, some things are important now and they're important later. So it's just a question of, you know, what my focus is at the moment. At the moment, it's being here and being part of my family and focusing on my tiny little baby boy. I think the older the child is, the more they understand. But you also just don't want to miss things, and you also don't want to be killed, you know, and really miss things. You know, you've just got to really weigh the opportunities versus the risks. And I think, you know, to a large extent, that's really what the assignment in Iraq was all about. You know, you got to really sort of weigh the risks of what you're doing and decide whether the risks are worth going. You can treat not every foreign assignment is going to be as nasty as Baghdad.
When you were reporting from Iraq, how much were you trying to report about the war and how much about what was happening within Iraqi society?
Well, I think the two are intertwined. I think it was impossible. You couldn't talk to an Iraqi without them talking to you about the situation. The situation is we have no security. The situation is I have no job because there is no security. The situation is I can't go to my house because there's no security because of the situation. You know, so I mean, there was just it was not even a big elephant. I mean, this was staring everyone in the face. There was no sort of talking around it. How are you living with, the constant danger, the U.S. military presence, the Iraqi security forces? How are you getting by? How are you providing for your family? How are you going to school? How are you, going to the doctor? Just facets of different, everyday life. I mean, how do people perform? Just the most basic duties, going to buy groceries. How can you go to the grocery market when the market gets blown up? I mean, it's just that's everyday life, and that's really on the ground. I wasn't a military historian. You know, I did not go in there to talk about the surge and all of the personalities involved and the strategies and the tactics and all that. That's not my focus. I don't do that. I focus on the people who it actually directly affects, and that's the people who have no choice about it and people who sort of were visited on by all these different forces. And those are the Iraqi people, and they're the ones who have the quietest voice, I guess, you know. They're less likely to be heard from because everyone's debating what's happening to them, and no one sort of sits there and says, "Okay, well, actually, can anyone listen to what I have to say?" They're the ones who are affected by it all. So they were my story, really.
When you get responses from listeners or from your bosses at NPR, do they respond more to the internal Iraqi stories or to the war stories?
You know, I think I've gotten more response from people about the Iraqi stories. We did a story about these volunteers who wade into the Tigris every day, several times a day, to pull out bodies that have been people who executed further upriver and dumped in the river, and they've sort of waded down to this point in this village. And these people would go in there every day with their bare hands and pull the bodies out and wait for the police to come and collect them. And I cannot tell you the response we got from listeners after hearing that story. People were writing saying, "I just want to send them life jackets. I want to send them diving equipment. I want to give them money to buy a boat." We were completely blown away, and the people that we talked to were blown away by the response. And it was just, it's amazing what moves people, and it's always been stories like that. I did a story about this poor girl who would take too many sleeping pills just because she wanted to numb herself against everything that was happening. And I had people who wanted to bring her to America to raise her and take her to school, and it's amazing what people will do when, you know, they what they're moved to do when they hear stories. And I think ultimately, I mean, war really is about these people. These are the ones who are being affected by it. These are the ones who are most helpless. And our listeners are incredible. You know, just the way that they respond is, you know, always blown me away. You know, I think that's the wonderful thing about radio, is that it is so intimate. And it does get such a personal response from people.
Do you feel you want to respond yourself personally?
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard. You know, when you speak to widows and they don't know where their husbands are, and you know, they ask you, you know, do you think you could ask? And you, because you have access, you think, you know, I could talk to this person. It's difficult, you know. I've never done anything personally, but I would have always sort of, you know, made sure that, you know, our Iraqi staff sort of keep tabs on the people. You know, wonderful, wonderful man who worked at the Baghdad morgue. You know, I mean, he worked at the morgue, and every day he had to deal with several dozens, at least maybe 100, in the height of the civil war, when, you know, he told me, you know, you have to lay bodies outside on the cement in the sun, because there was no more room for them inside. And he had such an amazing sense of humor. You know, he would talk about how when he would come home, his wife would make him take his clothes off at the front door because she didn't want him coming into the house smelling of death, you know, and how before he had a car, he used to take the bus and he used to feel sorry for the guy sitting next to him because he knew that the smell was horrible. You don't just sort of meet them, interview them, and leave them, especially in Iraq, especially when their stories are so powerful. You just always want to know what's going on with them. And, you know, you just try, do what you can, but you really can't do a lot. I mean, we can't really. We just rely on other people to do it. And our listeners have been really good about that.
You were head of the bureau, right, for a couple of years?
Yes.
What's it like running a bureau in Baghdad?
It's like running any sort of Middle East bureaucracy, I think. A lot of personalities, a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of drama. But, you know, every day was especially – 2006 was the worst year, because that was the year that the civil war really showed its teeth, when, you know, Baghdad basically divided up and – all these executions were happening in the dead of night, and all these bodies were turning up the next day. And we got to a point where we didn't know who was going to come to work next day. And we started to sort of stagger their shifts, so they would stay in the bureau, they'd stay with us, and, you know, for several days, and then go home for several days and change up your routine. So people who might want to kidnap you, you know, will have to keep on guessing about whether you're going to be in the same place at the same time the next day so they can take you. And, you know, we had responsibilities to people. We, you know, our office manager was kidnapped. The father of one of our staff was kidnapped. And, you know, the suicide bomber blew himself up around the corner from around the corner of the car that two of our staff were in. They face the dangers more than we do, and you're responsible for people. And that's, you know, when you think about their welfare, it's sort of a different responsibility to running a bureau in another country or another city. You know, you're actually directly, and, you know, it's not just you come in 9 o'clock in the morning, you're sort of, you know, hover around the water cooler and talk about what happened on American Idol last night. You know, it's not like that at all. You know, you wake up. You go downstairs bleary-eyed, and, you know, Waleed, you know, might cork would, you know, say, "Good morning, Jamie." And they're like, "Don't talk to me until I've had my coffee." And, you know, they're there every morning, and you sort of congratulate them because they turned up, because they made it. And, you know, you talk about where they can go and what you can do and wherever you wanted to go. And I'd say, "Yeah, okay, I think you can go there." And, "No, please let me just go on my own," sort of thing. And it's just a completely different way. And you've got to think about food, and you've got to think about electricity and, you know, water. And it's like your basic survival things that you need to have to get by should the city shut down. What do you do if you need to evacuate the bureau? You know, what are you, if there are helicopters leaving off the roof of the embassy? I mean, you've got to think out every scenario. What happens if the compound gets overrun? What happens if militias try to come in? What happens if someone tries to get kidnapped? You know, I mean, there are all these different. You know, you have to fill out all these secret questions with you with your security consultant. So if, you know, the kidnappers get you, they ask you these questions for proof of life. And that's terrifying to even think that you even have to get to that point. And you know, one of the things that I did in 2004 before I went back to Iraq was I had to write my will. And, you know, I was in
like
the lawyer's office.
Like every soldier does.
You know, and my father walked out of the office. He just didn't want to deal with it. You know, and it's just it's a completely different way of thinking. It's a way of life, and it's just, yeah, I don't know.
Do you ever fear that some reporters have said that they've had a feeling that they are suffering from post-traumatic stress?
I think everybody has. I think everybody who has covered this war has been affected by it in some way or another. And, you know, We talk to people, certainly, because it can manifest itself in different ways. Anger, you know, road rage, my favorite, airport rage. you know, and it's just it's really important to talk to somebody about it, because you know it's an issue and it's important, and you need to think about it to help yourself. So there's definitely I don't think PTSD is a dirty word. I think that everybody who has had some trauma, especially in Iraq is not normal. Anyone who's been there, you know, knows that it's not normal. And if you've had any sort of direct encounters with doing your work properly, then you'd have had some sort of experience with trauma, and you know, hopefully you'd also know how to deal with it, and that there's help available. I just think that, and I think now, especially, you know, with journalists as well, it's not such a sort of, you know, tough guy, you know, it's no big deal, blah blah blah, I'll carry on. People are, you know, talking about it more and dealing with it more.
Finally, perhaps a couple of brief comments about your current project on reporting America's Muslims.
Yeah, it's a 2-year project, and there are about 6 million Muslims in this country, and it's a quite diverse community. There are immigrant Muslims as well as an African American Muslim community, and I think that's the key thing, is to not think that they're this sort of monolithic entity. And so many of them who have come here, it's almost like the quintessential American experience, have come as immigrants to make a new life for themselves, and trying to sort of marry that with their religion and often their culture is something that I find incredibly fascinating. I did a series last year on arranged marriages. That is something that a lot of them deal with. You know, this young 25-year-old girl who was considered too old at 25 by her family and her relatives, that she hadn't been married, and sort of, you know, fighting that in her own way, and also sort of trying to forge her way ahead. It's a really fascinating thing to see the way that it's not just how the communities try to assimilate into American culture, but also how the cultures within themselves try to come to grips with with like the younger generation and the older generation. I think it's a typical immigrant experience in many ways. And you also, on the other side of that, you have the African American Muslim experience, and it's different because a lot of them would have been born Muslim because their parents converted during the time of the Nation of Islam. And you know, what are their experiences now? And you know, do they feel more Muslim or less Muslim as opposed to, you know, people who've come from South Asia? You know, what are the relations there like? And you know, I just think there's so much there that we don't know. And the sad thing is that after September 11, they sort of felt like they didn't really want to be heard, want to be noticed, you know, because they didn't want to draw attention to themselves, because there was such a negative view of Muslims. But, you know, you got people who are American first, Muslim second, and suddenly it's like, okay, why am I a terrorist? And, you know, so there's just a lot of, just a lot of issues there that haven't really been looked at that we're you know, studying at NPR and hopefully be reporting on more, you know, this year.
That brings us to the conclusion of this conversation. Our guest today has been NPR correspondent Jamie Terabay. Jamie, thanks for visiting with us.
Thank you.
To our listeners, we're pleased you joined us. We close with more music. This is Bob Dylan's Tangled Up in Blue. For WFIU, I'm Owen Johnson.
Early one morning, the sun was shining. I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like Mama's homemade dress. Papa's bank book wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through, tangled up in blue. She was married when we first met, soon to be divorced. I helped her out of a jam.
The program you have just heard was recorded in March of 2009. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.